Good morning. How's everyone doing?
Just fine.
Nice to see you all this morning. And welcome. So this morning, come on in. This morning I'm going to tell a story, as I am wont to do. This is a story from my childhood. And so I'm going to start with the setting. The setting is North Dakota, southeastern North Dakota. That's where I grew up. Now, some of you have heard about this before because I've told stories before and I've given this setting. So if you've heard it before, I beg your indulgence. It's important to the story, and not everyone has heard it. And besides, we need to wind up a little bit before we really get going here. So this was the Red River Valley. This is the southern end of the Red River Valley, which is a very flat place. And the reason it's a flat place is because it is the bed, it was once the bed of glacial Lake Agassiz. Okay? So the setting here is geological. I mean, I'm really doing the setting, so settle in. This could take a while. So glacial Lake Agassiz, it covered the Red River Valley in North Dakota and Minnesota, a little bit in South Dakota. Anya's excited, right? She's a geologist. And vast areas of Canada, okay? So the area was really flat. I mean, just amazingly flat. When it would rain, the water would just stand there in the fields, and a plowed field might look like a lake. The roads were all laid out in a grid. There was no reason to vary the roads, so it was kind of like living on a chessboard or something. There weren't very many trees. You know, there just weren't trees growing wild. There were shelter belts that people had planted to stop wind erosion. We would stand at the end of our driveway and wait for the school bus in the morning, and we could see the school bus if we looked very carefully when I think it was 5 miles away, this little tiny yellow dot, because there was nothing to block the view. And there was a farm maybe every mile or so. There weren't many people. So it's kind of this vast and empty space. And some people would drive through and they would say, "There is nothing there. There is nothing there." And they were wrong. Because it was a beautiful place. They were not looking. We had the ditches. We lived on a federal highway, Highway 81, a two-lane blacktop paved highway. And there were ditches on each side, and there were red-winged blackbirds in the ditches, and they sing with a particular trill. They just have the most beautiful song, and they'll be sitting on these reeds. You know, the reeds are kind of waving, and they're there. And there are the meadowlarks with their beautiful song. And in our farmyard, we had barn swallows, which would just glide around in the barn in these little nests that they made that adhered to the side of the made out of kind of dried mud, and they would sail around, and they were just beautiful. And there were the wheat fields. So, and then the grain fields, fields of wheat, you know, fields of wheat waving in the wind, or grass just in the ditch waving in the wind. If you ever watch that, it's just the most beautiful thing. But it wasn't totally flat. It wasn't totally flat, because we had a creek very near our farm called Antelope Creek. And this was a creek that just kind of wound its way for many miles. It had a lot of bends in it. Maybe every mile it would have three or four major bends in it. And it emptied into the Wild Rice River, which emptied into the Red River, which emptied eventually into Hudson Bay in Canada. And so where this creek was, there was a slight dip in the land. It wasn't a big hill. It was enough of a hill that if you're riding your bike down toward the bridge, you can coast and get up a little speed, you know. And there was one place where we would take our sleds in the wintertime. There was just enough of a hill that you could get up a little bit of speed. So that's different, you know, that's different from the flatness. So we were drawn to this. And there were trees down there. There were trees lining the creek all the way. And there were some places where there might be a big bend or something where there were actual forests. I mean, large areas with lots of trees. And this was about only about a distance of, say, 2 blocks from our house. So my brother Jim and I, Jim was 2 years older than me, we'd go down there all the time. And we called it the crick, not the creek. We called it the crick. And we'd go there in the summer every day, probably several times a day. and we'd go there together sometimes, or I'd go there alone, and we'd just wander. You know, we'd ride our bikes down the gravel road to the bridge. This was a one-lane plank bridge with metal on the sides that was maintained by the township, just a little bridge. So two cars couldn't meet there, but two cars never would because there just wasn't enough traffic. So we'd leave our bikes in the ditch and we would walk, and it was a great place to play, you know, to engage in fantasy and see wildlife and just be, you know. And you didn't need a reason to be there or a project or something. You just walked it. You just walked it. And it was a place of great adventure. There was the place where my dad shot the badger under the bridge. And there was a place where someone had started to build a cabin but had never finished it, and I wondered what was the deal there, what was their plan. There's a place where we always saw an ermine, which is what you call a weasel in the wintertime when it has turned white. There were the beaver dams. And there was one time I found a mourning dove nest which had three eggs in it instead of the usual two. They always have two. And I was so excited, I wrote to the Audubon Society and reported this. Yes, I did. And I'm confident that letter is in their files somewhere to this day. And there was this place where I tried to jump over a beaver dam on my skates one time. And I was a terrible skater, still am, just not good at it at all. And I tried to jump over this beaver dam, and I landed on a stick, and it made, I'm afraid, a hole in my knee. The funny thing was, it didn't hurt at all. I felt no pain at all, but it made this big hole. And Jim tore, I think, the sleeve off his sweatshirt and wrapped it around there for a bandage because it was really bleeding. And we thought I probably shouldn't skate home because that would encourage it to bleed. So I was on my skates, and he kind of towed me. He kind of pulled me a half mile home, you know. And so we went to the doctor, and I got 7 stitches. And it was so cool. It's like I got this wound. I was really proud of it. So, and there was this place about a half mile down the river from the bridge, so that's north of the bridge, which was occupied by beavers. And so we have the level of the fields, and then there's a little dip, and then there's a flat place, and there's another dip down to the creek itself. And the beavers had spent a lot of time in there and really just kind of cleaned out the forest. They took all the little sticks out, and there were all these little sort of chips on the floor, and just the middle-sized trees, no big ones and no little ones. And it was like the beaver's living room. And it was just the most pleasant place. And we used to go down there with our tent. We'd camp overnight. We had this tent which had no floor, no screen, just flaps. And we would camp there. And had a really, it was a fun place. And in the late summer, the vegetation would get really lush and overgrown, and you'd have insects buzzing and everything. In the wintertime, it could be really stark. It could be really beautiful with a heavy snow falling on all of that. It's just this black and white landscape of all of these dormant trees and all of the snow. And it was so quiet during a big snow, especially it seemed like in the evening when you're starting to go home. It was just so quiet. So it wasn't our land. It was our neighbor's land, a big family. They were named the Johnsons. And they had a farm on the river that was about a half mile south of the bridge. And they didn't mind us being on their land at all. You know, we were good friends with them. And we almost never saw anyone down at the creek itself. There weren't any other kids around. I think the nearest other kid was a mile and a half away. And the adults wouldn't go down there generally because they had work to do and just not time to wander in the woods. Except there was this one guy. There was this one guy, and his name was Floyd. He did a lot of hunting and trapping. And we would encounter him down there from time to time. And he was one of the Johnsons, and he still lived at home. He lived at home with his parents there, even though he was an adult. And it's hard to know just how old he was, because I was little, and when you're little, everybody just looks really old. But I'm guessing he was probably around 40, or maybe 35 to 40, somewhere in there. And he never seemed to have a steady job. He would sometimes work for a farmer in the area. There was a farmer just north of us who had a lot of land, and he would hire our friend Floyd to do field work for him. And Floyd was a good storyteller, And he would tell us stories about farming. And there was one about how, about moving some machinery in the wintertime, that his boss wanted him to move some machinery. And it was like the coldest day of the year. And he didn't know why he chose that particular day. And we didn't know about wind chill back then, you know. But in North Dakota, it gets down to 30 below a few times every winter. And it seems like about once every winter it gets down to 40 below. So it can get incredibly cold. And can't remember all of the details of the story, but I think maybe the farmer sort of asked him to move this machinery and then kind of forgot him out there, and he almost froze to death. He made it a good story anyway. So he was, so Floyd, he was about, I'd say, medium height and kind of thin and kind of wiry and kind of dark complected and kind of had leathery features from being outside all the time. And I remember him, you know, it's hard, it was so long ago, but I bring him into my mind and I remember him with this little smile. It's like he always had this little smile. No matter what expression he had on his face, it's like he had this little smile underneath it that wanted to break through. Almost like he was trying to hide the little smile, you know, because you're supposed to be serious and adult and grown up and stuff, you know, but he just can't help it. Like he was always amused at life and always kind of having a good time. And so people really liked him, you know, we really like people like this. And then one day he moved in across the road from us. So we're on Highway 81, and there's a dirt road on our side, and there's a gravel road on the other side, so we're at the intersection. And across from us is this other farm, this old farm. And there's not much left there anymore except the house. And it was kind of a wreck, and it belonged to the Johnsons. But they fixed it up some, and he moved in there. And that was really great. So Jim and I, we'd go over and see him a lot. And I was around, I think, 12 at this time, and Jim was 14. Floyd, he always had time for us. He'd always hang out with us and talk with us. And we would throw darts in his basement. He had a dartboard. And it was one of those basements where, you know, you go outside and you lift up the double doors and you go down in. It was like that. It was cool. He was an interesting guy. One time he went to a junkyard and he bought some car radios, not just a few car radios. He bought like 75 car radios. And he was going to fix them all up and sell them because he was good at that kind of thing, you know. I think he probably read Popular Mechanics and things like that, which those things were popular back then. And as I said, he did a lot of trapping. So he would trap along the creek. These were leg hold traps. And I know trapping is a really cruel business, and it probably should be banned if it hasn't been already. But that's not what this story is about. He did a lot of this. It got him out into the woods every day, which he loved, and he could make money at it. You could make $30 for a mink. That was a lot of money back then. And my brother Jim was the one who was good at all of this stuff, you know, hunting, trapping, farming, all of that stuff. I was always kind of on the outside of that, kind of wishing I could do that stuff better. But Jim was really good at it. And Floyd taught Jim the details of trapping. And it wasn't long at all before Jim got his own mink. And I was pretty impressed by that. I was in awe, actually. And he would take us fishing. We would fish off the bridge there in Antelope Creek and maybe catch a few bullheads, just a few. You know, a bullhead, if you're not familiar with them, it's this little slimy fish with whiskers, and you can eat them, and I don't think they taste very good, but I certainly ate enough of them. but one day he took us fishing on the Wild Rice River, which was a big river, you know, a nice big river. Antelope Creek is pretty small. It's maybe 20 to 30 feet wide, and there was one time it dried up completely. In the spring, it might get really, you know, a quarter mile wide because all the snow melts and everything just floods up there, but it's pretty small. But the Wild Rice River was a real river, always flowing, and there was this place where there was a dam, so we'd park the car and we would walk maybe about a half mile to this dam and fish there. And I remember this one day, there were so many fish there below this dam, and he and Jim each caught about 50 or 60 bullheads that day. and I did not have a fishing pole. This is kind of the story of my life as a kid, because there was no money for stuff like that. And Jim always found out a way to get money, and he would buy what needed to be bought. He would get the baseball or the fishing pole or whatever. And I had a wire with fishing line wrapped around it. And so I couldn't cast. So I had to kind of place myself on the cement by this, just below the dam, up above the dam. I would place myself there and unwind the thing and just kind of drop my line in there. But even I caught 16 fish that day, which I thought was pretty cool. And Jim, he's got like, oh, I got a big one, and he's pulling it in, and he's, wow, it feels really big. And he pulls it up, and it's this huge fish. It's not a bullhead. It's like this long. And he's pulling it in, and he gets it up, and it's right there, and it's this beautiful, incredible big thing, and I'm not sure what it is. And Floyd says, you got yourself a northern, Jim. And just at that moment, the line broke.
Oh, no.
And the northern went back down in the water. But that's okay. He caught a northern. So we took all those fish. We had them in buckets. We took them home. We were out in the yard. We got some other buckets to sit on. We started cleaning the fish, you know. And Floyd started telling us stories and stuff. And we kept talking. My mom came out. My dad came out. And it was just a really, really fun day. We love this guy. We love this guy. And he'd drop over now and then. He would, like, need some postage stamps or something. He'd drop over and he'd talk a while. And, yeah, he'd just been out to Montana. And, you know, you can buy land for $20 an acre in Montana. And he was thinking of relocating. And I think that's probably true. I think you could. One time there was an accident on the highway right between our two farms. It involved a car and a cement truck. And it wasn't too bad. Nobody really got hurt. But the truck got damaged, and they had to get rid of all of that cement. So he got a new sidewalk and a driveway out of the ditch. Yeah, he did. And he had some hog wire he used for steel, because you got to put in steel when you're doing that kind of thing. And he made some forms out of 1x4s and found a board or something to use for a float. And, like, I'm standing there watching all this, like, wow, this is an exciting day. Car accident, new driveway, all this stuff. Woo! Crazy stuff. That's a great thing about growing up in sort of a empty, plain place. Anything you do is really exciting. But there's more to this story, and it's not all a happy story. Because the reason he lived on the fringe and he didn't have a steady job, I mean, some of this was choice, but, well, he had a drinking problem. He drank. And I didn't know much about drinking. My parents, my grandparents didn't drink at all. And I never saw him drunk except one time. And it was hard to reconcile what I knew about this guy with the stories I had heard about him. But I know he had had a horrible experience in the military. And people said that's why he drank. And I don't know if that's true or not. You know, could have been PTSD. Could have been bipolar. I don't know. People just didn't go and get help in those days, you know. It just wasn't available. But most of the time, when he lived across the road, he was sober most of the time. But when he drank, he drank. He had some buddies who would come around, and they'd go out, and they'd go on a bender. You know, he'd go on a bender for a while, and then he'd stop for a while. And in fact, he had once lived elsewhere, and he had had a lot of stuff. He had a different kind of life, and he had really lost it all. And the one time I saw him when he had been drinking, it was just briefly. As I said, we had a dirt road on our side, and when it would rain, it would just turn to mud, and you really couldn't drive there, maybe with a tractor, but not with a car. And one time after it had really rained, he came driving down that road with his car. And it was just solid mud, and he pulled in, and it's, you know, solid mud. So he asked Jim, will you wash my car? I'll give you $3, you know. And Francis, that's my dad's name, you want to come have a beer? So my dad sat in a car with him and had a beer. My dad didn't even drink, but he liked the guy, you know. And, of course, he's not going to refuse him. But it seemed like most of the time he was doing really well. And he got a job after a while. He got a job in town at a meat market. And that was great. it was a steady job, you know. He'd come over and he'd tell us about what it was like to work in a meat market, and it sounded really interesting. And he'd say, I'll sharpen your knives for you. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll take them in. You know, he was proud of himself, and we were proud of him too. And my mom actually went to the meat market one day and bought some hamburger, which she would never do because it was more expensive in the meat market than it was in a store. But we went in there just to see him, and he waited on us, and he filled up this little paper carton with hamburger. And I remember that so clearly, how he was behind the counter there, and he took a little meat and he put it in the thing, and he took a little more and he put in a little more, and he packed it down a little bit, and he got some more. And it just took him forever to fill this thing up. And I was thinking at the time, this guy is so slow. Is that how he works? But looking back on it now, I think what he was doing was, you know, this is for my neighbor who really cares for me. And I'm going to do the best job I possibly can to do this thing for her. You know, he was just being very mindful and very respectful. So one day we were down at the creek, and it was kind of an unusual day because I remember my dad was there, and Jim and I were both there, and Floyd was there too. And I can't remember why we were down there, but I know we were doing some kind of work because my dad had brought a pitchfork along. And Floyd used that pitchfork to pry something up. I can't remember what, but I remember he broke the handle. He just broke it. He said, "Oh, I'll get you a new pitchfork." And while we were down there, we were looking around for beavers because the beavers had moved from where they were up into this area. And we were kind of watching for them. And I notice he gets this kind of heightened awareness, you know, like he's really looking at something. And then he kind of signals us, you know. And we know what it is, you know, he must have spotted a beaver. And this is a pretty rare thing. I mean, since then I've seen beavers a few times. But at that time I had never seen one in the wild. That is a very rare thing. How many people have ever seen a beaver in the wild? Wow, I guess it's not that rare. Okay. Okay. Well, let me just get my bearings here. So he has this heightened awareness, right? And everybody is kind of watching. And what do? I like come rushing forward to see the beaver. And I make noise, you know. And of course, it's gone like that. And Floyd just kind of goes, well, it's gone. And he moves on. He doesn't look at me. He doesn't do anything judgmental. He doesn't say anything. But I know what I just did, you know. And felt really badly about it. You know, it depends on what you value. But for some folks, seeing a wild creature that they ordinarily would not see and being able to watch that creature for a while can be just like one of the coolest things that ever happens. And I learned something about that. And I've been pretty quiet in the woods since then. And people like Floyd have this reverence when they go into the woods, you know. When you're in the woods with them, they start talking in really hushed tones. They're really quiet. And they walk very softly. And they don't go knocking around or hitting things or yelling or anything. And part of that's because, you know, you don't want to disturb the animals. You never know who you might see. So you just walk very, very quietly. But it's more than that, I think. It's that you respect the animals because it's their space, you know. And you respect the woods. You just respect everything out there. You don't want to take up too much room. You leave no traces. You don't know what you might harm by not being mindful. You respect the mystery out there. You respect all of life out there. And that's why it's so strange for me if I go to a state park or something in a beautiful, isolated place and I see people out there kind of yelling and screaming and acting crazy. It just doesn't seem right to me. So, and I knew this other guy who had that same kind of reverence. this other guy. Later, when Jim and I, you know, were grown up, we were doing construction work. We were building grain elevators, and we would travel around and we would, you know, camp and do this stuff. And we had this friend. He was like the third tool brother. He looked a lot like us. He had long hair like us. We all wore jean jackets. We all hung out together. And I'd go out in the woods with him, and he had that reverence. And he had this way of doing things, which all just seemed to kind of be based on respect for the process. I went fishing on a fishing trip one time with him. We went canoeing. But before we went on the fishing trip, we had to go to this ditch he had found and use a net to get bait, to get chubs, because you don't buy bait. You get your own bait. That is the proper way to do it. And we put this canoe in on the Des Moines River. This is down by Fort Dodge, Iowa. I built a lot of elevators down there. And the Des Moines River down there is pretty wide and pretty wild, and a lot of wild country. A lot of wild country down there. Really nice. And so we canoed down the river, and it was a lot of fun. The river was pretty high. And we stopped at some point and pulled up on the shore because he wanted to shoot some squirrels. He had his rifle along, a 22, just a little rifle. And we came to a place where he saw a squirrel up ahead of him, and he takes a bullet out of his pocket and he puts it in his rifle. And I learned later, he says, "Oh, you never put your bullet in until you see the animal you're going to shoot." And I thought, well, that's an interesting approach. That's very safety-minded, and there seems almost something respectful about that. So he shoots the squirrel with one shot, and we take it with us and further down the river, and we camp on an island in the middle of the Des Moines River. And this island, it had trees on it, and I would say it was maybe about 4 times as long as this room, and not much wider than this room. And we set up our tent there, and built a fire, and made us a squirrel stew, and it was really good. That's the only time I've ever eaten squirrel. It was pretty good. And then we went in the tent for the night, and it started to rain. It started to rain really hard, and the corner of our tent got. Was just all water, and we kept kind of moving over, you know. And truth be told, we'd had a few beers, and it didn't bother us that much. And we got up in the morning to find that the river had risen and the island had shrunk, and it was now just about the size of our tent. And I thought, wow, you know, if that had gone up about one more foot, that would have been really interesting. But fortunately, he had the good sense, because he does these things right, to tie up the canoe, and it was still there. That was very fortunate. So we kept going. That was a great, great trip. And he was like that with campfire. Very respectful and had a certain way of doing it. There's certain ways you do campfires. And we did a lot of them because that's how we would cook. We lived outside on these job sites. So usually in the evening, that's what we did. We cooked a meal, you know. And there's a certain way to build a fire. You pay attention to what kind of wood you're using. You never use wood with nails in it. You never use wood that's been painted or anything like that. And you build it up slowly and you add it in a certain way and you don't make it too big and you don't let it die out, you know. And I really caught some of that. And I now inflict that on my family because we have a fireplace. And they know that I have rules about fires. But they know that, you know, they don't really make sense. But it's best for to just let me do the fires. So back to Floyd. This thing happened this one winter that I'll never forget. And it was just the smallest thing, just the smallest encounter, but it really made an impression on me. And we were younger at this time. I think we were maybe 8 and 10 at this time, really kind of little kids at this time. And he still lived with his folks at that time. And we were down at the creek in the winter time. And so the creek, you know, creek bed, it's full of snow, really deep snow. And on each side are these kind of huge snow drifts. They're really like snow cliffs. cliffs, you know, and they're probably 10 or 15 feet high, you know. And so we were climbing up those and falling down and climbing up and falling down and fooling around and having a lot of time and kind of laughing and yelling and screaming, you know. And we looked up, and there he was, Floyd. He was right there. Like, we hadn't noticed him because we were yelling and screaming and, you know, acting like town kids in the woods. But he's walking in the middle of the creek with this steady gait, heading home. You know, it's in the evening. And we became immediately quiet. And he smiled. He always had that little smile. And he said hi, and he kept on going. Did not break his stride a bit. And that really surprised me. I thought, he didn't stop to talk. That's not like him. And I think I was a little hurt at first. But then I thought about it, and I knew why he hadn't stopped. It's because he was in his element. You know, he was in his space. He was in that very quiet, reverential space, and we were shouting and playing and acting stupid, and he just wasn't going to kind of dishonor the space he was in. And we respected that. And I thought, he taught us more when he kept on walking than he ever could have if he had stopped to talk with us. So that's when we were a little younger. Now, back to the time when we were down at the creek and we saw the beaver, and back to this time. A few days after that happened, my dad was driving into town, a nearby town, a mile and a half away, tiny little town. He was going to the grain elevator to take care of some business, and he was driving on this gravel road. And he saw that Floyd's car had run off into the ditch. And this was not unusual. You know, this had happened before. And so he stops, and he goes over to the car to make sure everything's okay. And he was in there. Floyd was in there. My dad told me about it later, and he said he knew right away he was dead. You know, and he had been doing so well. You know, he'd been doing so well. So my dad went on into the elevator, and they called someone, and they took care of stuff. And my dad came home, and he told us about it. He said in the back seat there was a new pitchfork handle, and that's what really bothered him. You know, it's funny where our mind goes at times like this. We always think, oh, geez, did I do something? You know, and it's like, oh, why didn't I say, forget the pitchfork? You don't have to buy one. Just forget it. You know, we love you, but you don't say those things. So I know it was some kind of natural causes. I don't know what exactly. And we went to his funeral. And I think it was the second funeral I had been to. And he was a veteran, so they shot off the guns like they do. That was the first time I'd seen that, but believe me, not the last time. And that was it. And that house sat empty for a while. It sat empty. And then they got some renters in there, and I remember thinking, these renters that moved in, that they just didn't know anything at all. And I felt this absence, this great absence. So that's the story. And the question is, why, you know, why do I tell you this story this morning? Why am I telling this story? I feel like this story kind of wanted to come out. I was actually working on something else. I was working on a Dharma talk about something about the importance of teachers, something about how nature can be a teacher. I was thinking about Thoreau. I was thinking about Emerson. And I started looking to my childhood for illustrations, and I started having, you know, memories about this particular person. And it's like, that's a story I want to tell. That's a story. It's like, this story wants to come out. It has something to tell me, and I need to listen. Like sometimes happens when you're on a retreat or something. Something just comes up. Something bubbles up. And I probably never really processed this stuff as a child. I think it's hard for children to think about death, you know. If someone dies and it's not someone really close in your immediate family, you might have the attitude like, well, I'm sad, but all the adults are crying, and I think I should feel sadder, but I don't, you know. And I probably just wanted to go outside, you know. That's how I wanted to deal with it. So this is a matter that's personal to me. But I find that if I pay attention to the things that really have the most to say to me, that sometimes they move other people as well. So that is my hope. My hope. So my question is, what do we do with this? What do we do with this story, with this experience? Walking the creek, the snow, and the silence, and the dark side of it all, and the early death of this person I really loved, and the disappointment because you so wanted it to turn around, you know? And it was so close. It was so close. You know, what do we do with this? What do we do with this? So I've been thinking about this guy for years, and I like this story, and I want to tell it because it brings me to a very raw place. It's a raw place where there are these good memories, and there's this joy, and it's all this stuff tied up. You know, my folks who are gone now, and my brothers, and there's all that pain, and these things mingle together in a really uncomfortable way. And I keep wanting to talk about just the happy part, you know, and I want to send everyone home kind of feeling good. And we probably all know someone who's a little bit like my neighbor, you know, people who might experience more joy in life, might experience some things much more than ordinary people do. They may have this incredible sweetness, and they also have more pain. And you love them. And you love to be with them. And sometimes you just don't see them for a while because they've got stuff going on. And my friend from the elevators, he drank too. He was so much like this guy. So we know people whose pain wins out. And people you can't help. You try, and you can't. And you think if you only hit upon the right thing, if you could just do the right thing, you could fix them completely. For all time, you know. But you can't. You're powerless. My parents were so kind to this guy. But ultimately, it was not in their control. So, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. That's what we say here. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And it's often been noted that this, which I think is our most basic vow, the most basic expression of who we are, beings are numberless, I vow to free them, that this expresses an impossibility, that we're trying to do an impossible thing. And usually we say the reason it's impossible is because there are so many beings. They are numberless. That's why it's impossible. We can't possibly save them all. But it's also an impossibility in a way, because there's only so much we can do. Each person has to save himself or herself. If we have a wayward child, we do everything we can, and sometimes we think if we could just do a little more, we could fix it. And the hardest thing of all is to accept sometimes that our power is limited. And that just breaks our heart. But we need to accept that. It doesn't help this person at all if we beat ourselves up about this and say, it's me, it's my fault. It's not. It's not. And the way to help this person is to just do what you can do, you know, and accept that there's some things you can't do. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. So that's what we do with our lives. We save all beings, even though it's impossible. And why do we vow to do the impossible? Why do we vow to do the impossible? This question comes up a lot. Or maybe it's just me. It just keeps coming up for me. But I think it comes up sooner or later for most Buddhist practitioners. And I don't think it's because of doubt. I don't think anyone thinks, well, should I really help all beings? I'm not sure about that. I mean, we all know that, right? We know in our hearts that that's what we're here for. We're here to save all beings. So why does the question come up? I think the question comes up because we want to understand. We want to know if the Buddha's message is coherent. Is there a coherent philosophy here? We want a philosophical underpinning for the idea that the proper thing to do in the world is to do good. And that's the problem. I don't think it's the nature of human existence that we can get a logical answer to this question. It's beyond us. The truth does not lie in logic. There is truth, but it's not in logic. It's in an experience. It's a thing you experience. You experience through our practice, and maybe in other ways, but the practice is the way I know of that works the best. And this is similar to a question I brought up repeatedly in the recent Heart Sutra class that I taught. There's a class on the Heart Sutra and the Paramitas, and we offer this class from time to time. It's basic Mahayana Buddhism. The Heart Sutra is all about emptiness, or seems to be, and the Paramitas seem to be a lot about compassion, about dana, generosity, giving. So we teach both of these things. Too much emptiness is cold. Compassion alone can be kind of sloppy. So I asked the person who had taught it before that, Susan Nelson. I don't know if she's here today. I asked Susan, so what's the deal with this class? What should I know? And she said, it is hard to get that connection between emptiness and compassion. So I stressed that a lot in the class, and I presented it as a koan. I presented it as a koan. This is something for us to work on. What is the connection? And I have a way of explaining it. I have a way of explaining it, which is that the Buddha taught emptiness. Everything is empty. That does not mean that things don't exist. That does not mean that things don't matter. What emptiness means is that nothing exists independently. Nothing exists on its own. Everything that exists is interrelated with everything else. There are these causes and conditions. Everything is connected. And so if nothing exists independently, still things do exist interdependently. There is a way that I am connected with all of you. I'm really not separate with you, from you. I know it really seems like I'm separate from you, but I'm not. We're really just the same. The border between me and you is illusory. And if that's really true, well then, your well-being is as important to me as my own well-being. There's no difference. Emptiness, compassion. So I think that answer will do, but it's really a logical answer. It's really not sort of the deep thing that you kind of get, you can get in a way that's beyond logic. But the fertile place for the kind of experience I'm talking about, the experience of this, is the place of not knowing, that place of discomfort. That place of weirdness, we might say. I'm thinking of the weather we've had the last couple of days. Yesterday, there is no weather more strange than rain on snow. You just think, what is this? You know, can we get over this and have some real weather? March is just, it's an odd time of year. It's an uncomfortable combination, you know. And so we tend to think, well, when this is over, you know, I'll get back to paying attention to the world. But, you know, it is possible to kind of move. These places of discomfort have something to teach us, right? We can move toward that. Why do I feel so uncomfortable about this? Why do I feel so weird? Why is this dreariness getting to me? What's going on there? So this raw place, that place where you go, you know, for you people listening. So what I'm doing here is I'm sitting here. People really do listen. Even people from North Dakota. Hi, Catherine. So I'm sitting here, and I've kind of got my palms up, and I've kind of got this quizzical look on my face, like, what? What is this? And many times I've been with Zen groups, and I've felt that kind of expression in the room. Like, everybody's feeling that at the same time. And I remember one time in Northfield, I was part of a group down there, and we had had a particularly good teaching and a particularly good conversation, and there may be 8 or 10 of us who had been practicing together for a long time, and we kind of get to this point where we fall silent, and we're sitting. And somebody says, I feel like we're sitting around a great dark well, and we're just looking into it. And I knew exactly what they meant. And I think everybody in the room felt exactly the same thing at the same time. So here we are. Here we are. We are present with the mystery. We don't have an answer, but we're present with the mystery. And I've felt that same kind of feeling here many times, you know, morning study group and various groups when the discussions are good. Here we are with the mystery. And when you're with a group like that and you're here with the mystery, it's not so bad. It's not so frustrating. It doesn't seem to hurt so much. It kind of feels like, wow, here we are. Here we are with this thing, you know. And it can even be peaceful. It can even be comfortable. And it definitely is, wow. There's that. So that place of discomfort is very, very fertile ground. And it's a good place to be. We all crave comfort, and that's fine. And we come to Zen Center and we get some comfort here, and that's fine. That's wonderful. But it's essential to recognize that Zen Center is going to push you toward that discomfort too. And I think that's why we come here, because I think we know that. Gently and kindly push you toward that discomfort. And you don't have to do it alone. So there's this state of grace, I think, that comes when you've lost everything, or you've given up everything, or you've been liberated from everything. It's all the same thing. There's this state of grace that is beyond suffering and joy. It's the state of grace that comes with recognizing that there is no state of grace. And it tells you just what to do. You keep walking, one foot in front of the other. You stand up in the moment. You take care of things. And you save all beings. And all of this raw and beautiful, tragic world is present there in every step. And sometimes, a lot of the time, really, all of this ripens into play. And I haven't talked too much about play, but remember all the playing down at the creek, down at the crick? That's a really big part of this, too. It's a really big part of this. So that's what you do. And that's what I have to say this morning, and thank you very much for listening. And we have not too much time for questions, but one or two maybe? Okay. Or comments? If anyone has something.
I'd like to say thank you for sharing a story.
You're welcome.
We come here and a Dharma talk has a bit of a different flavor, but I think everybody has stories, and recognizing the value of experience and of allowing people into sharing that with people, sharing your own personal experience with people as a story, as an event that communicates a very personal reflection of your experience of life is valuable and not enough. People are as unfettered to do that. There aren't as many people that are able to do that, just to tell a story, just to share part of their experience that's personal, and I think it's valuable.
Yeah, well said. It is valuable, I think. And this practice is not generic. It's very personal for each of us. It's about what's going on in here and what's been building up in there for a long time. So the stories are important. All the stories are important.
Yeah.
Thank you. Back here?
Yeah, just real quick, when you know, ask the question, it's freeing all beings, it's impossible, then why do we try?
Yes.
What's the alternative
to freeing all beings? Yeah. What is the alternative? What, doing nothing? Giving up?
Yeah.
Just no. No, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's even worse than giving up. I think, again, it's a lot of what we're seeing throughout the world is oppression and injustice and impoverishment of the human imagination and creative impulse. I think it leads directly to the world situation we find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you repeat that line? You said it really resonated with me. It was to the, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was to the extent, like, kind of when this messiness is over, I'll get to it, something like that.
March.
I think I was talking about the weather. Yeah. I mean, yes, yeah, you feel like, I want this to be over so I can start paying attention to the world again when it'll start making sense.
Yeah.
And that's what we do with our feelings of discomfort. Like, as soon as I can get rid of this, I can get back to being alive again, you know. And this practice teaches us to know you go into the discomfort, you spend time with it. There's so much you can learn there. And also the practice teaches us that fighting off the discomfort sort of gives it strength, you know. And then you start building this whole thing to fight it off. Better to just go there and be with it. I mean, that's about standing up in the moment that Katagiri talked about so much. It's being with the thing that's here now. And that thing may be.
It's about time.
It's about time.
So.